This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Dry by Neil and Jared Schusterman. Read by the authors and Jenny Barber, Michael Crouch, Noah Galvin, Kivligan DeMontebello, and Candace Thaxton.
This book is dedicated to all those struggling to undo the disastrous effects of climate change. Part 1. Tap Out. Day 1. Saturday, June 4th. 1. Alyssa.
The kitchen faucet makes the most bizarre sounds. It coughs and wheezes like it's gone asthmatic. It gurgles like someone drowning. It spits once and then goes silent. Our dog, Kingston, raises his ears but still keeps his distance from the sink, unsure if it might unexpectedly come back to life, but no such luck. Mom just stands there holding Kingston's water bowl beneath the faucet, puzzling. Then she moves the handle to the off position and says, "Alyssa, go get your father." Ever since single-handedly remodeling our kitchen, Dad has had delusions of plumbing grandeur. Electrical, too.
"Why pay through the nose for contractors when you can do it yourself?" he always said.
Then he put his money where his mouth was. Ever since, we've had nothing but plumbing and electrical problems. Dad's in our garage working on his car with Uncle Basil, who's been living with us on and off since his almond farm up in Modesto failed. Uncle Basil's actual name is Herb, but somewhere along the line, my brother and I began referring to him as various herbs in our garden. Uncle Dill, Uncle Thyme, Uncle Chive, and during a period our parents wish we would forget, Uncle Cannabis. In the end, Basil was the name that stuck. "Dad!" I shout into the garage, "Kitchen issues!" My father's feet stick out from underneath his Camry like the Wicked Witch. Uncle Basil is hidden behind a storm cell of e-cig vapor. "Can't it wait?" my father says from beneath the car. But I'm already sensing that it can't. "I think it's major," I tell him. He slides out and with a heavy sigh heads for the kitchen. Mom's not there anymore. Instead, she's standing in the doorway between the kitchen and the living room. She's just standing there, the dog's empty water bowl still in her left hand. I get a chill, but I don't yet know why.
"What's so important that you gotta drag me out of..."
"Shush," Mom says. She rarely shushes Dad. She'll shush me and Garrett all day, but my parents never shush each other. It's an unspoken rule. She's watching the TV, where a news anchor is blathering about the flow crisis. That's what the media's been calling the drought, ever since people got tired of hearing the word drought. Kind of like the way global warming became climate change and war became conflict. But now they've got a new catchphrase, a new stage in our water woes. They're calling this the tap out. Uncle Basil emerges from his vapor cloud long enough to ask,
"What's going on?"
"Arizona and Nevada just backed out of the reservoir relief deal," Mom tells him. "They've shut the floodgates on all the dams, saying they need the water themselves." "Which means that the Colorado River won't even reach California anymore." Uncle Basil tries to wrap his mind around it.
"Turning off the entire river like it's a spigot? Can they do that?"
My father raises an eyebrow.
"They just did."
Suddenly, the image switches to a live press conference where the governor addresses a gathering of antsy reporters.
"This is unfortunate, but not entirely unexpected," the governor says. We have people working around the clock attempting to broker a new deal with various agencies.
What does that even mean? Uncle Basil says.
Both Mom and I shush him. As a precautionary measure, all county and municipal water districts in Southern California are temporarily rerouting all resources to critical services, but I cannot stress enough the need to keep calm. I'd like to personally assure everyone that this is a temporary situation and that there is nothing to be concerned about. The media begins to bombard him with questions, but he ducks out without answering a single one.
Looks like Kingston's water bowl isn't the only one that's run dry, Uncle Basil says. I guess we're gonna have to start drinking out of the toilet, too.
My younger brother, Garrett, who's been sitting on the couch waiting for normal TV to return, makes the appropriate face, which just makes Uncle Basil laugh. So, Dad says to Mom half-heartedly, at least the plumbing problem isn't my fault this time. I go to the kitchen to try the tap myself, as if I might have the magic touch. Nothing. Not even the slightest dribble. Our faucet has coated, and no amount of resuscitation will bring it back. I note the time, like they do in the emergency room. 1:32 p.m., June 4th. Everyone's going to remember where they were when the taps went dry, I think. Like when a president is assassinated. In the kitchen behind me, Garrett opens the fridge and grabs a bottle of Glacier Freeze Gatorade. He begins to guzzle it, but I stop him on the third gulp. Put it back, I tell him. Save some for later.
But I'm thirsty now, he whines, protesting.
He's 10, 6 years younger than me. 10-year-olds have issues with delayed gratification. It's almost finished anyway, so I let him keep it. I take note of what's in the fridge. A couple of beers, 3 more bottles of Gatorade, a gallon of milk that's down to the dregs, and leftovers. You know how sometimes you don't realize how thirsty you are until you take the first sip? Well, suddenly, I get that feeling just by looking in the refrigerator. It's the closest thing I've ever had to a premonition. I can hear neighbors out in the street now. We know our neighbors, run into them occasionally. The only time whole bunches of them come out into the street at the same time is July 4th, or when there's an earthquake. My parents, Garrett, and I gravitate outside as well, all of us standing strangely, looking to one another for some kind of guidance, or at least validation that this is actually happening. Jeanette and Stu Leeson from across the street, the Maleckis and their newborn, and Mr. Burnside, who's been eternally 70 years old for as long as I can remember. And as expected, we don't see the reclusive family next door, the McCrackens, who have probably barricaded themselves inside their suburban fortress upon hearing the news. We all kind of stand there with our hands in our pockets, avoiding direct eye contact, like my classmates at the junior prom.
Okay, my dad finally says. Which one of you pissed off Arizona and Nevada?
Everyone chuckles. Not because it's particularly funny, but it eases some of the tension. Mr. Burnside raises his eyebrows.
Hate to say I told you so, but didn't I say they'd hoard what's left of the Colorado River? We let that river become our only lifeline. We should never have let ourselves become so vulnerable.
Used to be no one much knew or cared where our water came from. It was just always there. But when the Central Valley started to dry up and the price of produce skyrocketed, people started to pay attention. Or at least enough attention to pass laws and voter propositions. Most of them were useless, but made people feel as if something was being done. Like the Frivolous Use Initiative, which made things like throwing water balloons illegal.
Las Vegas still has water, someone points out.
Our neighbor Stu shakes his head.
Yeah, but I just tried to book a hotel in Vegas. 1 million hotel rooms and not a single one available.
Mr. Burnside laughs ruefully, as if taking pleasure in Stu's misfortune.
124,000 hotel rooms, actually. Sounds like a whole lot of people had the same idea.
Ha! Can you imagine the traffic on the interstate trying to get there? Says my mom in a sour grapes kind of way. I wouldn't want to be caught in that. And then I put my 2 cents in. If they're diverting the remaining water to critical services, it means there's still a little bit left. Someone should sue to get them to release a fraction of it. Make it like rolling blackouts. Each neighborhood gets a little bit of water each day. My parents are impressed by the suggestion. The others look at me with an "isn't she adorable" kind of expression, which ticks me off. My parents are convinced I'm going to be a lawyer someday. It's possible, but I suspect if I am, it will just be a means to an end. Although I'm not sure what that end would be. But that doesn't help us now. And though I think my idea is a good one, I suspect there's too much self-interest among the powers that be for it to ever happen. And who knows? Maybe there isn't enough water left to share. A phone chimes, receiving a text. Jeanette looks at her Android. Great! Now my relatives in Ohio found out. Like I need their stress on top of my own.
Text them back, send water, my father quips.
We'll get through this, my mom says reassuringly. She's a clinical psychologist, so reassurance is second nature to her. Garrett, who's been standing quietly, brings his Gatorade bottle up to his lips. And for a brief moment, everyone stops talking. Involuntary. Almost like a mental hiccup, as they watch my brother gulp the quenching blue liquid. Finally, Mr. Burnside breaks the silence.
We'll talk,
he says, as he turns to leave. It's the way he always ends a conversation. It signals the conclusion of this loose little fellowship. Everyone says their goodbyes and heads back to their homes, but more than one set of eyes glance at Garrett's empty Gatorade bottle as they leave.
Costco run, says Uncle Basil late that afternoon at around 5. Who's coming?
Can I get a hot dog? Garrett asks, knowing that even if Uncle Basil says no, he'll get one anyway. Uncle Basil is a pushover. Hot dogs are the least of our problems, I tell him, and he doesn't question that. He knows why we're going. He's not stupid. Even so, he still knows he'll get a hot dog. We climb into the cab of Uncle Basil's 4x4 pickup, which is jacked up higher than it should be allowed for any man his age. Mom said we have a few water bottles in the garage, Garrett says. We're going to need more than just a few, I point out. I try to quickly do the math in my head. I also saw those bottles. 9 half-liters. 5 of us. That won't even last the day. As we turn the corner out of our neighborhood and onto the main street, Uncle Basil says,
It may take a day or so for the county to get the water up and running again. We'll probably only need a couple of cases.
And Gatorade, says Garrett. Don't forget the Gatorade. It's full of electrolytes. Which is what they say on the commercials, even though Garrett doesn't know what an electrolyte is.
Look on the bright side, Uncle Basil says. You probably won't have school for a few days.
The California version of a snow day. I've been counting down the days for junior year to end. Just 2 weeks now. But knowing my high school, they'll probably find a way to tack any lost days on at the end, delaying our summer vacation. As we pull into the Costco parking lot, we can see the crowd. It seems like our entire neighborhood had the same idea. We do nothing but slowly circle in search of an empty space. Finally, Uncle Basil pulls out his Costco card and hands it to me.
You two go in. I'll meet you inside when I find a place to park.
I wonder how he'll get in without his card, but then Uncle Basil finds ways around any situation. Garrett and I hop out and join the hordes of people flooding the entrance. Inside, it's like Black Friday at its worst. But today, it's not televisions and video games people are after. The carts in the checkout line are stocked with canned goods, toiletries, but mostly water, the essentials of life. Something feels slightly off. I'm not sure what it is, but it hangs in the air like a scent. It's in the impatience of the people in line. The way people use their carts, on the verge of being battering rams to make their way through the crowd. There's a sort of primal hostility all around us, hidden by a veneer of suburban politeness. But even that politeness is stretching thin. "This cart sucks," Garrett says. He's right. One wheel is bent, and the only way to push it is to lean it on the other three wheels. I look back toward the entrance. There were only a couple of carts left when I grabbed this one. They'll all be gone now. "It'll do," I tell him. Garrett and I forge our way through the crowds toward the back left corner where the water pallets are. As we do, we overhear bits and pieces of conversations.
"FEMA's already slammed with Hurricane Noah," one woman tells another.
"How are they going to help us, too?"
"It's not our fault. Agriculture uses 80% of the water."
"If the state spent more time finding new sources of water instead of fining us for filling our swimming pools," one woman says, "we wouldn't be in this position."
Garrett turns to me. "My friend Jason has a giant aquarium in his living room, and he didn't get fined." "That's different," I explain to him. "Fish are considered pets."
"But it's still water."
"Then go drink it," I say, shutting him up. I don't have time to think about other people's problems. We have our own to worry about. But it looks like I'm the only one who cares, because Garrett has already gone off to hunt for free samples. As I push the cart, it keeps veering to the left, and I have to lean heavily on the right side to prevent the bent wheel from acting like a rudder. As I approach the rear of the warehouse, I can see that it's the most crowded spot. And as I reach the last aisle to see the water pallets, I realize I'm too late. The pallets are already empty. In hindsight, we should have come straight here the moment the taps were turned off. But when something drastic happens, there's a lag time. It's not quite denial and not quite shock, but more like a mental free fall. You're spending so much time wrapping your mind around the problem, you don't realize what you need to do until the window to do it has closed. I think of all those people in Savannah the moment Hurricane Noah made that unexpected turn and barreled straight toward them instead of heading back out to sea like it was supposed to. How long did they stare unblinking at the news until they packed up their things and evacuated? I can tell you how long. 3.5 hours. Behind me, people who can't see that the water pallets are empty keep pushing forward. Eventually, some employee will have the good sense to put a sign out front that says, "No water." But until they do, customers will keep piling in, pushing toward the back, creating a suffocating crowd, like the mosh pit of a concert. On a hunch, I maneuver my way to the side aisle and to the racks of canned soda, which are also beginning to disappear. But I'm not here for soda. As I look around the stacks of drinks, I find a single case of water that someone abandoned there, maybe yesterday, when it wasn't such a precious commodity. I reach for it, only to find it pulled away at the last second by a thin woman with a beak of a nose. She stacks it on top of her cart like a crown on top of her canned goods. "I'm sorry, but we were here first," she says. And then her daughter steps forward, a girl I recognize from soccer. Hallie Hartling. She's annoyingly popular and thinks she's much better at soccer than she really is. Half the girls in school want to be like her, and the other half hate her because they know they'll never come close. Me? I just put up with her. She's not worth the energy for me to be anything but indifferent. Although she always seems to bleed confidence, right now she can't even look me in the eye. Because she knows, just as her mother knows, that I had that water first. As her mother pulls their cart away, Hallie leans closer to me. "I'm sorry about that, Mauro," she says earnestly, calling me by my last name like we do in soccer. "Didn't I share my water with you at practice last week?" I point out to her. "Maybe you could return the favor and share a few bottles with me." She looks back to her mother, who's already moving down the aisle, then back to me with a shrug. "Sorry. They don't sell them by the bottle here, just by the case." And then she gets a little bit red in the face and turns to leave before it becomes a full-fledged flush. I take in my surroundings. Crowds are still getting thicker and things are vanishing from the shelves at an alarming rate. Even the sodas are gone now. Stupid. I should have grabbed some. I hurry back to my empty cart before someone else can take it. There's no sign of Uncle Basil yet, and Garrett is probably off stuffing his face with something greasy. The Gatorade he requested is all gone, too. Finally, I spot Garrett. He's down one of the frozen aisles, pizza sauce all over his face. He wipes his mouth with his shirt, knowing I'll comment. But I don't bother, because I see something. Just past the frozen vegetables and ice cream, there's a chest packed with ice. Enormous bags of it. I can't believe people are such limited thinkers that they haven't thought of this themselves. Or maybe they have, but denied that they could possibly be so desperate. I open the door and reach for a bag.
What are you doing? We need water, not ice.
Ice is water, Einstein, I tell him. I go for a bag and realize they're a lot heavier than I had anticipated. Help me. Together, Garrett and I heave one bag of ice after another into our cart until it's piled as high as it can get. By now, other people have taken notice and have crowded the ice case, beginning to empty it. The cart is ridiculously heavy now and almost impossible to push, especially with a bad wheel. Then, as we struggle with the cart, the jammed wheels scraping across the concrete floor, a man in a business suit comes up behind us. He smiles.
That's quite a load there, he says. Looks like you could use some help.
He doesn't wait for us to answer before grabbing the cart's handle and wrestling it forward far more effectively than we did.
Crazy here today, he says jovially. Crazy everywhere, I'll bet.
Thank you for helping us, I tell him.
Not a problem. We all need to help one another.
He smiles again, and I return the grin. It's good to know that difficult times can bring out the best in people. Bit by bit, with short but steady lurches, we get the cart to the front of the store and into one of the snaking checkout lines.
I suppose that's my workout for the day, he chuckles.
I look at our cart and decide that one good turn deserves another. Why don't you take a bag of ice for yourself, I suggest. His smile doesn't fade.
I have an even better idea, he says. Why don't you take a bag of ice for yourselves, and I'll keep the rest.
For a moment, I think he's joking, but then realize he's dead serious.
Excuse me?
He manufactures a heavy sigh.
You're right. That really wouldn't be fair to you.
Tell you what, why don't we split it down the middle? I'll take half, you take half. He says it like he's being generous, as if the ice is his to give. He's still smiling, but his eyes scare me.
I think my offer is more than fair, he says.
I begin to wonder what business he's in, and if it's all about cheating people but making them think they're not being cheated. It's not going to fly with me, but his hands are firmly locked on the handle of our cart, and there's nothing to prove that it's ours and not his.
Is there a problem here?
It's Uncle Basil. He's arrived just in time. He glares at the man coldly for a moment. Then the man takes his hands off the cart.
Not at all, he says.
Good, Uncle Basil says.
I'd hate to think you were harassing my niece and nephew. People get arrested for that.
The man holds eye contact with our uncle for a moment before folding. He looks at the ice, his expression bitter, then leaves, not taking as much as a single bag. Uncle Basil's pickup truck is parked illegally, halfway onto an island, having demolished a row of ficus.
Had to kick this sucker into four-wheel drive, he says proudly, probably the first time he's ever actually had to use it.
Suddenly, Uncle Basil's midlife crisis truck is a blessing rather than an embarrassment. We load the bags of ice into the truck bed.
How about that hot dog?
Uncle Basil offers, trying to lighten the mood. I'm full, Garrett responds. even though I know that's a nearly impossible feat for him. He just doesn't want to go back inside. None of us do. And now there's a small crowd that's formed, watching us load the ice into the bed of the truck. Even though I try to ignore it, I know there's a dozen eyes on us. "Why don't I ride in the truck bed with the ice?" I suggest.
"No, it's okay," Uncle Basil replies calmly.
"Ride in the cab. Some nasty potholes on the way back. Wouldn't want you to bounce around back there." "Right," I agree as I hop into the cab of the pickup. And although no one speaks of it, I know it's not potholes my uncle's worried about. We pull into our street, but for some reason it doesn't quite feel like the same block I grew up on. There's this strangeness, like when you accidentally turn one street too early, and because all of the cookie-cutter houses look the same, you feel as if you're in a parallel universe. I try to shake the feeling as I watch the houses go by through the car window. Our neighbors across the street, the Kiblers, usually lounge in their lawn chairs and supervise their kids as they play, which in reality means gossiping over glasses of Chardonnay while making sure their children don't get run over. However, today the Kibler kids play tag in the street without supervision. And even through the children's laughter, there's this insidious silence that underscores everything. Then again, maybe the silence was always there, and I'm only just noticing it now. Uncle Basil backs the truck into the driveway, and we get straight to unloading. Even with the sun getting low in the sky, it's still 90 degrees, and the ice is already melting. If we're going to get all of this ice inside in time, we're going to need to hurry.
"Why don't you go clean out the freezer so we can put some ice in it?"
Uncle Basil says as he grabs the first bag from the truck bed.
"The rest we can let melt and drink today."
"Better yet, why don't you clean the downstairs bathtub?" I tell Garrett. "We'll let it melt there."
"Good idea," says Basil, although Garrett's not too keen on cleaning the tub.
Dad emerges from the garage, greasy wrench in hand, clearly still trying to squeeze water from the pipes.
"Ice, huh?"
"They ran out of everything else," I tell him, keeping it brief. Dad scratches his head.
"Should have gone to Sam's Club," he says. "They keep more items stocked in the back of the store."
Although Dad smiles it off, I can tell he's a little more disturbed than he lets on. I think he knows that Sam's Club has most likely been cleaned out of all its bottled liquids, just like every other store. Uncle Basil quickly changes the subject.
"Thought you were going into the office today," he says.
Dad shrugs and grabs a bag of ice.
"Best thing about having your own business is that you don't have to work Saturdays if you don't want to."
Except that Dad does work Saturdays. Some Sundays, too. A lot of people put in extra hours these days, considering how the price of produce has been rising. But even without that, Dad always told us that it takes a 24/7 commitment to build out a business. Yet apparently he'd rather haul ice than sell insurance today. I pull more ice from the back of the truck, but find, even in a thick plastic bag, it's hard to grip now that it's starting to melt.
"Need some help?"
says a voice from behind. And before turning around, I know exactly who it is. Kelton McCracken. You're not so typical red-headed geek next door. Most kids of his strangeness are content killing zombies with an Xbox controller, but not Kelton. He prefers to spend his time practicing aerial reconnaissance with his drone, shooting critters with his paintball gun, and hiding in his treehouse with a pair of night vision goggles pretending to be Jason Bourne. It's like he never matured past sixth grade, so his parents just bought him bigger and bigger toys. But today, I can't help but notice that there's something different about him. Sure, he's grown in this past year and looks a lot more mature, but it isn't just that. It's the way he holds himself. There's a bounce in his step, as if this whole water crisis excites him in some sick way. Kelton smiles, revealing that his braces are off and his teeth have been wrangled artificially straight.
"Sure, Kelton, we could use some help," says Dad. "Why don't you give Alyssa a hand?"
I go to hand him the ice, but as I hold it out to him, something comes over me. and I can't seem to let go of the bag. Dad takes notice, confused by my hesitation.
Let him take the ice, Alyssa, he says.
I look down to the ice in my hands and then back to Kelton, realizing I'm still skeptical about allowing people to help.
Is there a problem? Dad asks, in an intrusive, fatherly tone that demands an answer, which I don't give.
I force myself to hand the ice over to Kelton. Just don't expect a bag for helping, I tell him, which makes my father give me a stern look, probably wondering what would possess me to be so nasty about it. Maybe later I'll tell him about the guy at Costco. Or maybe I'll just try to forget it ever happened. As for Kelton, I expect him to have a snotty comeback, but instead he just stands there, genuinely thrown by my comment. I regain my composure and force a smile, hoping it doesn't look forced. Sorry, I tell him. Thanks for helping. We go inside to set the ice in the bathtub, but Kelton grabs my shoulder to stop me.
Have you sealed the drain? He asks. Not a good idea putting this ice in the tub unless you've sealed the drain. Even the tiniest leak, and you'll lose it all in a few hours.
I thought my uncle had done that, I tell him, even though none of us would have thought of it. As much as I hate to admit it, that's probably the smartest idea I've heard all day.
I'll go get you some caulking, he says, and hurries off to retrieve the sealant from his garage, obviously happy for an opportunity to put his Boy Scout training into action.
Kelton and his reclusive family always seem to have a worst-case scenario plan for anything. Dad would sometimes joke that Mr. McCracken lived a double life, working as a dentist by day and preparing for the end of the world by night. But recently, the joke is becoming all the more real. It seems Mr. McCracken now spends most of his time welding cast-iron contraptions late into the night, as if he were drilling into the cavity of the gaping monstrosity that is his garage. Over the past few months, Kelton's family has assembled an over-the-top surveillance system, set up a mini greenhouse in their side yard, and lined their entire roof with some kind of unregistered off-grid solar panels. Most recently, Kelton, who's in far too many of my classes this year, is always bragging about his father-installed one-way bulletproof windows. Bullets can shoot out from inside, but can't penetrate from the outside. Even though the rest of our class thinks he's completely full of it, I think it might be true. I wouldn't put it past his father to do something like that. Aside from our complaints about the late-night welding, our families are generally amicable, but there's always been a sense of polite tension when my parents deal with them. We once shared an area of grass between our two houses, until Mr. McCracken installed a picket fence right through my mom's prize-winning vermiliads. The fence was obnoxiously taller than your typical whitewashed suburban barrier, but just low enough not to technically violate the rules and regulations of the homeowners association, which they always seem to be at war with. Once they even tried to lay claim to the curb in front of their house as their own private parking spot, insisting that their property line extended a few inches into the street. But the association won that battle. Ever since then, Uncle Basil makes a point to park his truck right in front of their house whenever he can, just to mess with them. Kelton returns in a few minutes with the caulking and gets right to sealing the drain. This might take a couple of hours to harden, so be careful when you pack the ice in, he says, way more enthusiastic than someone ought to be about silicone sealant. There's an uncomfortable silence between us that makes me realize that I've never actually spent time with Kelton one-on-one. Then something occurs to me that's not just a conversation filler, but something important. Wait a second. Don't you guys have a big water tank behind your house?
35 gallons, Kelton brags as he applies the caulking with the precision of a jeweler.
But that's inside our house. The outside one's for bodily waste, full of quaternary ammonium compound chemicals. You know, like that stinky blue soup at the bottom of a porta potty?
Yeah, I get it, Kelton, I say, duly disgusted. Well, I can't say you guys didn't think ahead.
which is the understatement of the century. Well, as my dad always says, we'd rather be wrong than dead wrong. Then he adds, I bet if your dad just thought ahead too, you'd probably be better off. Kelton's clearly not aware how insulting he can sound sometimes. I wonder if he ever won a merit badge for being most annoying. Kelton finishes up the job. I thank him, and he heads back home to shoot his potato launcher or dissect bugs or whatever a kid like him does with his free time. In the kitchen, my mom is scouring every surface with 409. Stress cleaning. When something's out of your control, you bring order to the things you can. I get that. She's never been the type, though, to leave the TV on as background noise, but she has it blasting in the family room. I'm not sure where my dad and uncle are, maybe back working on his car. I find it odd that I feel I need to know. On TV, CNN is focused on the continuing crisis of Hurricane Noah. I don't begrudge those poor people the attention, but wish some of it would turn toward us, too. Any news about the tap out? I ask. One of the local stations has regular updates, Mom tells me, but it's that brainless anchor I can't stand. And besides, there's nothing new. Even so, I switch to the brainless anchor, who my dad says got his start in porn, although I don't want to ask him how he knows. My mom's right. They're just showing the governor's statement from this morning and trying, without success, to spin it. I switch back to the national news stations, CNN, then MSNBC, then Fox News, and back to CNN again. Every national broadcast is reporting on Noah, and only on Noah. Slowly it dawns on me why. There's no radar image for a water crisis. No storm surges, no debris fields. The tap out is as silent as cancer. There's nothing to see, and so the news is treating it like a sidebar. I mention this to my mom. She stops cleaning for a moment and watches the crawl of secondary stories at the bottom of the screen. Finally, something comes up. California water crisis deepens. Residents urged to conserve. And that's it. That's all the national news says. Conserve? Are you kidding me? My mom takes a deep breath and sprays the kitchen table again. As long as FEMA does its job, who cares what the news says? I care, I tell her. Because if there's one thing I know about the news, it's that it decides for most people, including the federal government, what is and what isn't important. But the big news stations won't give the tap out the critical airtime it needs, not until there are images that are as dramatic as winds taking off roofs. And if it takes that long for the tap out to be taken seriously, it will be too late.
Snapshot, John Wayne. Dalton loves the way planes take off from John Wayne Airport. It's a real trip. They call it a modified noise abatement takeoff, and it was specifically implemented to spare Newport Beach millionaires from having to deal with airport noise. Basically, the plane powers up on the runway with its brakes on, then accelerates at full force into a ridiculously steep takeoff, followed 10 seconds later by a sudden leveling off and throttling down of the engines, which sounds to the uninitiated like engine failure, causing at least one person on every flight to gasp or even scream in panic. The plane then coasts out over the Back Bay, Balboa Island, and the Newport Peninsula before the pilot pushes the engines back to full and resumes the climb out. They ought to call it John Glenn instead of John Wayne, Dalton once said, because taking off from there was the closest most people would ever get to blasting off into space. Dalton and his younger sister are regular flyers, visiting their dad who lives up in Portland a few times a year, Christmas, Easter, most of the summer, and every other Thanksgiving. Today, however, it's not just the two of them traveling north. Their mother is coming too. If your dad won't put me up, I'll be happy to stay in a hotel, she says. He won't make you do that, Dalton tells her. but she doesn't seem too sure. A few years back, Dalton's mom had left him for a loser with nice pecs and a soul patch, who she subsequently kicked to the curb a year later. Live and learn. Anyway, when the marriage went south, his dad went north. "You understand this is not about your father and me getting back together," she tells Dalton and his sister. But for kids of divorce, hope springs eternal. Within minutes of the tap out, his mom had gone online and bought 3 overpriced tickets on Alaska Air, one of the few airlines that flies nonstop to Portland on a plane that you didn't have to get out and push. "Last 3 tickets," she told them triumphantly. "You've got an hour to pack. Carry-ons only." The trip to the airport is bumper to bumper. What should be a 15-minute ride takes almost an hour. The parking situation at John Wayne is the first indication that there's going to be turbulence up ahead. All but one parking structure says full. They get one of the last remaining spaces at the far end of the last lot. As they make their way to the terminal, Dalton notes all the cars circling like it's a huge game of musical chairs with no chairs left. The TSA checkpoint is a madhouse, which never happens here. "A lot of people are going on vacation," Dalton's 7-year-old sister Sarah says. "Yes, honey," their mom responds absently. "Where do you think they're going?" Their mom sighs, too stressed to continue humoring her, so Dalton looks at the boards and takes up the slack. "Cabo San Lucas," he says. "Denver, Dallas, Chicago. My friend Gigi's from Chicago." The security guy double takes on Dalton's passport because his hair is brown in the photo, but now it's bleached blonde. "You sure this is you?" "Last time I checked," Dalton responds. The humorless TSA guy lets them get into the slow-moving crawl to the metal detector, which has issues with his facial rings. Finally, they make it through security with just 5 minutes until boarding starts. Mom is relieved. "Okay," she says. "We're here. We haven't lost anyone. No missing fingers or toes." "I'm thirsty," Sarah says. But Dalton has already noticed that the concessions they passed all had "no water" signs up. "There'll be something to drink on the plane," their mother says. Dalton thinks that might actually be true. After all, these planes all came from somewhere else, and he is getting a bit thirsty himself. Then, just as they're about to start boarding, the gate agent comes on the loudspeaker and makes an announcement. "Unfortunately, we're oversold on this flight," she says. "We're asking for volunteers with flexible travel plans who are willing to take a later flight." Sarah tugs her mother's arm. "Mommy, volunteer!" "Not this time, baby." Dalton grins. Dad always tells them to volunteer because they give away hundreds of dollars in travel vouchers, which is always worth the inconvenience. But not today. Today it's all about getting out, which is why they have trouble getting volunteers. The price of the vouchers goes from $200 to $300 to $500, and still no one is willing to surrender their ticket. Finally, the gate agent gives up. She gets on the loudspeaker, calling the names of the last people to buy tickets. Dalton, Sarah, and their mother. Dalton feels a twisting in the pit of his stomach. "I'm sorry," says the gate agent, not sounding sorry at all. "But as the last to purchase, I'm obliged to reschedule you to a later flight." Dalton's mom goes ballistic, and he can't blame her. This is one time they need to fight the powers that be. "No," says their mom. "My children and I are getting on that plane." "You'll each receive a $500 travel voucher. That's $1,500, the agent says, trying to placate them. Their mom will not be bought. "My children have court-ordered visitation with their father," she yells. "If you take them off this flight, you'll be breaking the law and I'll sue." Of course, this isn't their father's time with them, but the agent doesn't know that. Even so, all the agent does is apologize and look for later flights. "There's a flight tonight at 5:30. Oh, wait, no, that one is full too. Let's see." She continues to hack away at her computer. 8:20. No. Then Dalton turns to his sister and whispers, "Give her the eyes." Their mom had always told both Dalton and Sarah that their big blue eyes could melt anyone into a puddle. Not so much Dalton anymore. At an awkward 17, with a bunch of facial piercings, a biohazard neck tattoo, and what his father calls weed-whacked hair, the general public isn't melted anymore. Only 17-year-old girls. But Sarah still has the magical melting effect on hardened adults. So he lifts her up for the agent to get a good look at her. "Aw, you're cute as a button," she says, then rips 3 new tickets from the printer. "Here you go. Tomorrow morning at 6:30. That's the absolute best I can do." So they wait. They don't leave because the crowd just grows and they know they'll never get back through security. They spend the night sleeping in uncomfortable airport chairs, getting sips of water from anyone who'll share with them, and there aren't many. Then, when morning comes, even with confirmed tickets, there's no room on the 6:30 flight for them. Or the next one. Or the next one. And they can't get tickets to flights to other places. And the airport gets so crowded that extra police are brought in to keep the peace. And with traffic jams everywhere, trucks with jet fuel can't get to the airport. And Dalton, his mother and sister, have to face the fact that they won't be blasting off anywhere. Day 2. Sunday, June 5th. 2. Kelton.
My dad always told me that there are 3 types of humans on this planet. First, there's the sheep, the everyday types who live in denial, spoon-fed by the morning news, chewed up by another monotonous workday, and spit back out across the urban streets of the world like a mouthful of funky meatloaf that's been rotting in the back of the fridge. Basically, the sheep are the defenseless majority who are completely unwilling to acknowledge the inevitability of real danger and trust the system to take care of them. Next, you've got your wolves, the bad guys who abide by no societal laws whatsoever, but are good at pretending when it suits them. These are the thieves, murderers, rapists, and politicians who feed on the sheep until they're thrown in prison, or better yet, belly up in a landfill alongside sheaves of your grandma's itchy hand-knit Christmas socks. The ones you ritualistically blow up every year with an M80. And lastly, you have people like us. The McCrackens. The herders of the world. Sure, our kind may look a lot like wolves. Large fangs, sharp claws, and the capacity for violence. But what sets us apart from the rest is that we represent the balance between the two. We can navigate the flock freely, with the ability to protect or disown as we see fit. My dad says that we're the select few with the power of choice, and when real danger arises, we'll be the ones who survive. And not just because we own a .357 Magnum, 3 Glock G19s, and a Mossberg pump-action shotgun, but because we've been prepping, in every possible badass way, since as long as I can remember, for the inevitable collapse of society as we know it. It's Sunday, noon, second day of the tap-out. It's boiling hot, like a forgotten soda can left out on summer solstice. I take to my personal bug-out, namely, the elevated tactical unit I built in the oak tree in our backyard. Some people might call it a treehouse, but that would insult its fortified and functional nature. You don't do infrared reconnaissance and maintain a civilian arsenal in some namby-pamby treehouse. It's nowhere near as cool as our real bug-out, though. A hidden safe house our family built deep in the woods in the event of a nuclear attack, or EMP, or any other end-of-the-world scenario. We all built it together, as a family a few years back, before my older brother Brady left home. If things get bad, I'm sure we'll go there. But in the meantime, I make do with my tree bug out. I've got quite my own stockpile of supplies, separate and apart from the stuff Dad has in our safe room. Weapons-wise, I've got a paintball gun, a tactical hunting slingshot, and a Wildcat Whisper pellet rifle. As far as supplies go, I have enough Mountain Dew to keep me awake for weeks if need be, not to mention chicken-flavored Top Ramen, my favorite comfort food, because it's comforting to know that in the event of nuclear fallout, my food has enough MSG and preservatives to outsurvive all of mankind. I look out the fort window and clock someone approaching our house, so I pull out my binoculars to get an ID. The off-brown suit and bolo tie are dead giveaways. It's Mr. Burnside, the retired business executive who never exactly came to terms with the end of his career. With nothing better to do, he organized a silent coup and took over the Homeowners Association a couple of years back. He's been running it with an iron fist ever since. We're pretty sure he's a fascist. He's probably here to notify us that our windows are too bulletproof, or that our garage door is too titanium, or that our rooftop aerial drone helipad is too awesome. But upon closer examination, I realize that he's not carrying the usual legal binder full of petitions and cease and desist paperwork. Instead, he holds a gift, wrapped up neatly with a bow and everything. I'm skeptical, so I climb down and move to the side of the house, crouching behind a hedge where I can see him at the front door. Burnside mats down his gray comb-over and knocks four times, then a fifth, because he's obnoxious like that. My dad answers, but only opens the door partly.
"Good afternoon, Bill. And to what do I owe the pleasure of your visit today?" my dad asks, when he really means, "What the hell do you want?"
Burnside forms a smile through a set of teeth too white to not be fake.
"Just checking in on families in the neighborhood."
He looks around our property, feigning enthusiasm.
"I have to say, I'm coming to understand and appreciate some of your unique modifications."
"Such as our greenhouse, which the association is still disputing," my dad says sharply.
"Water under the bridge,"
Burnside says with a cheap wave of the hand, his retirement-earned gold watch and medical ID bracelet jingling together. Not sure what his medical condition is, but 5'll get you 10" he didn't stockpile the medication he needs.
"Haven't you heard?" my dad says. "There isn't any water under the bridge."
Burnside laughs, but rather than cutting the tension, it just adds to it. So he hands my dad the gift.
"From me and the wife," he says. "Just a little something to help bygones be bygones."
"Well, that's awfully nice of you, Bill. I assume that means you and the board won't mind if I upgrade the security fences. I was thinking 10-footers.
Burnside gets a little bristly, but says,
"I'll have a talk with the board. It shouldn't be a problem."
"Is there anything else I can do for you?"
my dad asks, clearly enjoying the power position.
"Well, as I said, I'm out doing rounds to let everyone know that the Homeowners Association is making efforts to pool neighborhood resources. You know, to help each other out in this crisis."
Rather than responding, my dad waits for him to continue, making him squirm.
"I'm sure you and your family are doing just fine," Burnside prods, showing those porcelain teeth again. "But of course there are some others that were caught off guard by this water situation."
"Exactly what are you asking, Bill?"
my dad says, a little less jovial than before.
"We're asking everyone to make an inventory of supplies," he says, then adds, "I'm sure there are things you need that other people might have, and vice versa."
"From each according to his ability, to each according to his need."
"Isn't that the basic tenet of socialism, Bill?" my dad says.
"Never thought I'd hear something like that coming from a dyed-in-the-wool capitalist like you."
Boy, is my dad enjoying this.
Burnside's smile is starting to resemble a snarl.
"No need to be insulting, Richard. We're all in the same boat here. We should all try to make the best of it. If everyone's making an inventory, why are we the ones getting a gift?" my dad asks.
Burnside takes a deep breath and releases it.
"I know we've been adversaries in the past, but a little bit of goodwill on both our parts can go a long way."
Burnside then turns to go. But before he reaches the end of our walkway, my dad unwraps the present. It's a bottle of scotch, the expensive kind.
"Thanks again, Bill," my dad shouts to Burnside with a sly grin. "I bet it will make an excellent Molotov cocktail."
"On the rocks is best,"
Burnside shouts back, completely missing the joke.
"We'll talk."
Three. Alyssa.
I wake up late on Sunday. I had been up most of the night texting friends, trading stories about the day. Maura, who marched on City Hall with her family and a few dozen others, demanding satisfaction, Faraz, who spent the day with his dad trying to get their reverse osmosis water purification system to turn urine into drinking water, spoiler alert, it didn't work. And Cassie, who spent the day at her temple filling up water bottles for the elderly. It's a mitzvah, she told me, and our rabbi's son is hot. Still only half awake, I go into the bathroom and, by force of habit, turn on the shower, then realize I forgot to get a towel. I get one and come back into the bathroom, only to notice that the shower isn't on. Oh, right. Now I feel like an idiot. I was even thinking about the tap out when I turned on the shower, but somehow in my glorified monkey brain, I didn't make the connection that the shower head is a tap too. It's not that I didn't know it wouldn't be working. Of course I did. But when you're on morning autopilot, routine and muscle memory know no reason. I turn the knobs, not remembering which direction is on and which is off. Until the water comes back on, it's not going to matter anyway. No showers. What fun this is going to be. I slather on more deodorant than usual and head downstairs. Good morning, honey. Mom says, and tells me breakfast is a quarter of a watermelon that's been sitting in a corner of our refrigerator for a week. Garrett's rind is still on his plate like a wide green grin. It's an odd choice for breakfast, but she points out it has a high liquid content, so consuming it is killing two birds with one stone. And besides, it's almost lunchtime anyway. Before the water turned off, my plan for Sunday was to work on my paper on Lord of the Flies. My hypothesis is that had it been a group of girls abandoned on the island instead of boys, it would have gone a lot differently. When I suggested it to the teacher, the boys in class agreed and were convinced that everyone would have died a lot sooner. My hypothesis was, of course, the opposite. I had procrastinated for over a week in writing the paper, and it was due on Monday. Suddenly, it didn't seem to matter all that much. It was already announced that our school district would be closed tomorrow, and besides, try as I might, I couldn't bring myself to care about who held the conch shell and who was tormenting Piggy, or Miss Piggy, in my theoretical version. Still, I figure it's better to keep busy than to dwell on things. I resolved to seek out normalcy and decide to hang out with another friend, Sophia Rodriguez, who wasn't answering texts last night. After a few more unanswered texts, I decide I'll just go knock on her door like I used to back when we were younger. I slip outside and head toward her house, one street down from my own. As I walk, I take stock of the current state of my neighborhood. Most every car windshield is fly-specked and covered in dust. A large majority of lawns are neglected or replanted with succulents. Some people even had their dead lawns painted green, kind of like the way funeral homes put makeup on dead people. The frivolous use initiative wasn't just about banning water balloons. It also made it illegal to fill up private pools. The pool thing seemed like a good idea at the time. After all, in a time of drought, a pool is an extravagance. But since then, people with pools used the remaining water in them to wash their cars and water their lawns and such. Between that and evaporation, most pools are now totally empty. So what used to be mini neighborhood reservoirs are now all as dry as our sinks. I arrive at Sophia's house and see her father strapping suitcases to the roof of their Hyundai. At first, I try to tell myself that maybe he's taking another road trip for business, but as soon as I spot Sophia's favorite pink weekender bag strapped to the roof, I can't deny the truth. They're packing up and heading out. Sophia's inside the house, her father tells me, without taking even a moment's break from packing. I enter their home through the garage door. On the inside, everything looks normal. Same hallways, same blue pastel walls, same floral print couch. Yet for some reason, everything feels different, as if it's not the same house that I practically grew up playing in. And then I notice why. The TV is off, and the air lacks that sweet smell of Mrs. Rodriguez's cooking. Family pictures have been taken down, leaving bright squares against the sun-faded walls like shadows of the memories those walls once held. It's as if the house has been stripped of all those little things that made it a home. And then I think about my home, about how we keep all of our goofy family photos downstairs for everyone to see. And although I either hate my hair or my smile or my clothes in every picture I'm in, I couldn't imagine having to actually physically take them off the walls. Sophia emerges from her bedroom, sees me, and gives me a hug, holding me for a second longer than normal, and then pulls back, smiling weakly. I was going to stop by your house before we left. Where are you going? I ask. South, she responds. The short response strikes me as odd, because on any other day I couldn't pay Sophia to keep her mouth shut. I remember that she has grandparents somewhere in Baja, the western peninsula of Mexico, and it all starts to make a little more sense. Though I can't imagine Mexico being any better than Southern California right now. Most of it is a desert, too. Have you been watching the news? She says. They're saying even the Los Angeles aqueduct went dry. It's been dry for weeks, and they kept it a secret. People are resigning and being fired left and right. They're saying LA's water commissioner could be brought up on criminal charges. Why don't they do something about it instead of spending time blaming people? I know, right? Anyway, my father thinks it's gonna get worse before it gets better. She gives a nervous chuckle. Of course, you know him. He's always overreacting. I laugh, but it's more of an obligatory laugh than a real one. Mrs. Rodriguez enters the room, Sophia's five-year-old brother in one arm, a stack of Sophia's paintings in the other. Which of your pieces do you want to take? All of them, Sophia responds, without the slightest hesitation. She puts the paintings down on a pile of them already resting on the dining room table. Pick your three favorites. She kisses her daughter on the head and then smiles warmly to the both of us. Sophia's mother was always one of those women who was so pretty, people would mistake her and her daughter for sisters. She was youthful in every way. I always loved that about her. But today, she just looks tired. Sophia sifts through the canvases. This one is yours, she says, turning to me. You painted it for me back in 7th grade art class, remember? Yeah, I say. It was a birthday present. I think you should keep it, she says. Well, let's just say I'm borrowing it back, for a week or so, I correct her. Yeah. Sophia smiles genially, even though her eyes tell a different story. She was always the glass-half-full type, but something about the way she looks at me now tells me that her optimism is running as empty as her pool. My dad is that guy who avoids going to doctors at all costs. It's not that he never gets sick or has a deathly fear of needles, but I think some part of him thinks that drawing attention to an issue makes it worse. Maybe it makes something imaginary real. And since a vast majority of illnesses eventually go away on their own, most of the time it works for him. It's how he handles all of his problems, from fights with mom to a bad fiscal quarter for his business. So tonight, he declares a family dinner, which is his favorite communal band-aid. Sure, throwing lasagna at the issue isn't always the answer, but I am a firm believer that when mom and dad cook together, it has the power to turn any day around. So I make sure to be home precisely at 7:30. As soon as I walk in the door, mom puts me to work as expected. She hands me an empty pitcher. Get some water for the table. A simple request that suddenly feels like I've been charged with a sacred duty. Sure, I respond. I go into the downstairs bathroom and dip the entire pitcher in the tub, and even after a day, there's still some ice. As soon as I return, I pour everyone a glass. Not too much, Dad says. I'm thinking we each do 6 cups a day.
I did the math, and the amount that we have should actually be enough for about a week at that rate.
I thought people were supposed to drink 8 cups a day, Garrett says.
Think of your 2 less cups as a long-term investment, he tells Garrett, who at this point could probably run his own company based entirely on Dad's cheesy business analogies.
Plus, Kingston needs water, remember? But just a cup, twice a day, Mom adds. I totally forgot about our dog, and feel guilty about it. I couldn't imagine rationing something as helpless as an animal.
I look to his water bowl and notice that it's empty, so when no one is looking, I pour him a little bit from the pitcher.
Uncle Basil arrives at the table last, and right away chugs his entire glass of water, giving himself a killer brain freeze.
Serves you right, Herb, Mom says, like he's a little kid. That's all you get tonight.
It's healthier to drink all your fluids 10 minutes before you eat, he counters. It allows your body to process the water separate from your food and absorb more nutrients.
And whether that's true or not, I decide to write it off as bro science.
I think Uncle Basil gets all of his scientific factoids from his beer buddies. That, coupled with the only A he ever got in school, in biology, and you've got yourself a recipe for misinformation. Despite Basil's words, everyone else takes their water slow. Perhaps because no one likes looking at an empty glass, which is true even when there's not a water shortage. The lasagna is extra tough tonight, being that Mom boiled the pasta in Dad's red sauce in an attempt to use as little water as possible. Dad waits for our reactions before tasting it himself.
I love it. Nice and crunchy, Garrett tells Dad.
Of course